from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about problems an anti-poverty agency called the Social Development Commission is facing and why operations have stopped.
I think right now the future of SDC would be a question mark of, does it continue, and if it does, what type of condition will it be?
Then we'll bring you a new episode of Chirp Chat and learn why raptors are so important.
Raptors are what we call indicator species. So what that means is that their abundance or their absence is actually an indication of the health of the ecosystem as a whole.
Plus, we'll explore a new book full of fun facts and quirky stories about Milwaukee. All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll visit the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center and learn all about their raptor program. But we'll start with this. An anti-poverty agency has suspended operations in Milwaukee. The Social Development Commission provides food services, childcare, and education support. Earlier this year, the agency admitted to misallocating funds. Staffing cuts followed and a state audit was ordered. Then last month, operations abruptly stopped, leaving many in limbo and in need of support. Gina Lee Castro and Carrie Spivak have been reporting on the problems at SDC for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They join Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez to talk about what happened.
So for folks who haven't heard of the SDC before, Social Development Commission, can you tell us just basically what they do or what they're supposed to do?
Basically, they've been around for quite a while. I forget the number of years. I'm thinking 60 or so. It's an anti-poverty agency. They run, I think it was 20 to 30 different types of programs, targeting obviously the poor. They have also have had over the years a couple of times where there's been trouble. This wasn't the first time that there's been controversy with them. There was controversy with them, I'm going to say about 10, 12 years ago. They lost the Head Start program. But the motives are good by running all these various types of training programs and what have you, and I believe food programs and all that type of stuff. So,
and so much has happened so quickly, it feels like, just from here's this audit that came out late last year to where we are now. Can you just go over a little bit of the timeline of your reporting?
Yeah. I think it started out in March, sometime probably early March, when we got a letter from Dr. George Hinton, the CEO, saying that there was a misallocation from the weatherization program, and they didn't say how much was actually misallocated. And then from there, they laid off all of the weatherization program staff. I think they fired the finance director, Patrick Kersenlohr, and then the board asked the CEO, Dr. Hinton, to resign. And then they laid off everybody and closed the doors on April 25th. And then they stopped making payments for these employees starting in April. April 15th, they missed that paycheck.
Then, so they're about a month behind on actually even paying their staff.
And vendors as well.
And vendors.
They owe money to contractors as well. And their contractors would tend to be smaller businesses.
I guess the question that I'm thinking of when I've read all of the reporting is, how does this happen?
How does it happen? You got a combination of incompetence. I mean, this stuff just ain't supposed to happen. And they operate pretty much out of public view. We've been to the past few meetings. It was just the other night that there were other people there, and that was like two or three, and that was it. Media doesn't cover them a whole lot, including the paper, and we cover them generally when they get in trouble. So you have an agency that gets very little coverage but has a budget of, what, about $30 million or so, I think? It was a big budget, so it's a pretty good recipe for problems when you have that much money and that little oversight.
The way that it's been described to me is like a quasi-governmental agency. And so what's murky for me as you're bringing this up is the relationship it has with taxpayer money, which a lot of this seems to be taxpayer-funded, government grant funded. Do we know anything about how they operate financially, just outside of the fact that we don't know what's kind of happening with their finances?
Yeah. I mean, as we've been doing this reporting, we've had to try to figure out, like, how much funding are they getting from the department administration? How much are they getting from the city? Who are all their partners? Like, we know, like, they have, like, the Department of Public Instruction.
Yeah, DPI.
There's so many that contribute to them. I know AmeriCorps, their senior department, supports some programming at SDC. There's just so much, like, pockets of funding. But the city just had a memo that they released end of last week, and the Department of Administration came over there and was looking at how much funding the city has actually given SDC, and they've given, like, millions of dollars from ARPA funding.
I don't know if we've said this explicitly, but the impetus for where we are now is that there were over $100,000 that kind of has gone missing. At least that's what they've shared.
Misallocated. Word, yeah.
Yes, yes. What do we know about this money and where it went?
I mean, we can tell you what they've told us, because we're still trying to get that answered. But they've told us that their finance director had misallocated it from the weatherization program to other programs. They've made it really clear to us that they don't suspect that he went and bought Ferraris or misused the funds outside of SDC.
But at this point, you don't know for sure. I mean, there's still investigations going on. As far as we know, law enforcement is not involved. But it's a pretty serious thing when, you know, money's misallocated, using their word, like that. I mean, how do you lose $150,000?
Mm-hmm. You know? Right. On top of the bills unpaid to both employees and contractors.
Yeah.
What do we know about the SDC leadership? In particular, I'm thinking George Hinton, who was asked to resign.
He, if I recall correctly, came there about 2012. He was an executive, I believe, at Aurora. Don't know all that much about him. Technically, it goes down as a resignation, but it sure sounds like a push. And again, it's just operating this low-key agency with a whole lot of money and very little oversight.
Mm-hmm. One thing I'd love to get to is that you all have talked to people who have really been crushed by what's happened. I'm thinking of some of the contractors you've talked to that have been owed a large amount of money, or residents who've lost these essential services to some of the most vulnerable populations in the city. Are there stories that stick out that come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, right now I've been speaking with a lot of those, the 31 daycares who suddenly lost the youth food service program from SDC. SDC was delivering food to them daily and weekly, and the only notice they got was on a Friday, like, afternoon. And so, like, come Monday, they didn't know what to do. And so they've been spending hundreds of dollars each week to support that, and a lot of them don't have kitchens. SDC was really filling a gap in our county with those services, because a lot of other major food services, like the Milwaukee County or Milwaukee Public Schools, they're really focused on, like, school-based food. They don't really, you know, have any reason to give food to a for-profit daycare, even though it's low-income subsidized daycares. So that's a major loss.
A ton of fallout for so many people. What does accountability look like going forward?
Good question. Well, the boss left, Dr. Hinton, he left. I don't know. I mean, the state's looking at it. There are audits going on. So if there's accountability, it could come from there. Whether there's not been any allegations of sticky fingers, but you do got to watch for that too. The biggest price is being paid now by the employees who aren't working and the clientele which are not getting services.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if there'll be any other real accountability on it except for the job loss of a couple of people.
Right. Yeah. It definitely seems like the community and the people that SDC served they're dealing with the greatest cost or
The biggest burden.
Yeah. The biggest burden from this loss.
So the doors are shut, staff's laid off, volunteer services are filling in the gaps that they were providing these services on. What happens next for SDC? Is this a case of them being too big to fail, considering all of the places that they were plugged into and their budget and their role in the county?
You got other agencies are stepping in and doing what they were doing. So I don't know. And if next time they come to the city or the state for money, how willing they will be to give them money, because this isn't their first time. I mean, this is at least the second or third time that they've had major issues like this. So I think right now the future of SDC would be a question mark of, does it continue? And if it does, what type of condition will it be? Because they've lost over the years, some of their, you know, largest programs, starting with Head Start about 10, 12 years ago.
I mean, already the mayor's office has said, halted all departments to stop paying invoices to SDC. And the DOA, the Department of Administration, has already said also that it's heavily scrutinizing every single invoice that SDC has sent.
And then you talked about the people individually that are affected. And I'm just wondering what comes next for them. I know that I saw that a lot of volunteers are kind of filling in for their tax services that they provided. But as far as the people who were owed back pay or contractors still on the hook for money, do we know what happens? Or are they just kind of left hanging and kind of waiting to, we'll see what happens next as well?
I think they're left hanging.
Yeah. I haven't heard anybody say, I'm going to cut a check for you. So
Yeah. I just hear a lot of, we're looking into it and, you know, starting conversations with those people. But I mean, we were just at last Thursday's SDC's board meeting, and one of the people on the call was a former employee who asked, when am I getting paid? And the board said they couldn't answer.
Gina Lee Castro and Carrie Spivak report for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. Heart disease is the number one cause of death for women in the United States and can affect women at any age. But despite the prevalence of heart disease in women, many don't know how to recognize the symptoms. This was the case for Linda Kiewit, who survived a heart attack in January. She's continuing treatment at Frederick and the Medical College of Wisconsin's Cardiac Rehab Center, and now shares her story in the hopes that fewer women will experience what she has. Linda and her doctor, Stacy Gardner, join Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Linda begins by sharing what she was experiencing before she was admitted for emergency treatment for a heart attack.
I never was guessing I would have a heart attack. I didn't believe it until they told me I was. And that was after a lot of things happening that were finally convincing me that was the case. So I had had a surgery 10 days prior, moved into the holidays, and then shortly afterward, you know, started back at work. I noticed that I was having kind of indigestion and a little bit of heartburn, and that continued for a couple of days. I have a history of reflux. I assumed it was reflux. I was treating like it was reflux, but it wouldn't quite go away. At the same time, it wasn't constant. It wasn't alarming. It was something that I thought, hey, maybe this is something related to post-surgery. Maybe I'm eating wrong coming out of the holidays. It's always an intense time for eating. Maybe I'd eaten oddly then. Just really didn't anticipate it. And then finally, on the final morning, I'd switched medications again. I woke up. I felt like, hey, this is going away. And then it came back. So then I called my surgeon, and he immediately said, you know what? I think you need to have this checked out. So that's when I went to the hospital. And even waiting to be seen, I was embarrassed. I thought, well, this is ridiculous. They're going to, you know, take a look at me and say you have indigestion, give me a prescription-level antacid and send me home. Well, that's not what happened.
And how many days of indigestion did you say it was?
About? It started on a Wednesday, and I went in on Saturday morning.
Okay, so prolonged indigestion problems. And then what was that conversation like when they told you what was actually happening?
It was traumatizing. They initially took my blood pressure. They were concerned. They then immediately took an EKG. And the EKG was so alarming, they thought they had made a mistake, and they took another one right away. And my husband later told me he was facing the EKG technician. I was not. He saw the EKG technician's face change and knew we were in trouble. So then they called what they call rapid response and told me a lot of people would be entering my area. They were there to take care of me. And then they continued to take steps to save me. In the ER, a lot was happening very quickly and in a very reassuring way as a patient, as reassured as you can be in that situation. But we immediately, both my husband and I knew immediately that there was something very wrong. At the same time, ER chaos is an odd thing. I'm not a huge fan of ER shows, but that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
Because it's controlled chaos. Everybody's doing exactly what they know they're supposed to be doing. At the same time, as someone who doesn't know what's happening, you are understanding the seriousness of it. And then when they were communicating to me what was going to happen next, they were calling in a cath team, and they were explaining to me what they were going to do. I started questioning them and said, why would you do this? What is actually happening? And then they gave me more information, and that's when I got very scared.
So, and then they explicitly stated you're having a heart attack.
They used words that explained that without being over-alarming to maintain some level of calm.
Mm-hmm.
They had lots of resources come in and, you know, be with my husband because he was standing there alone watching me have it and seeing everything that was happening. Him and I immediately communicated about different people to call and what to do next. And you do what you do when you know that you're in a very serious health situation that you're not sure if you're going to come out of.
So the onset was indigestion. That's something I would never assume is an indicator of a heart attack. So Dr. Gardner, you treated Linda. And with this presentation of symptoms, it can be different for anyone, but symptoms do differ somewhat in women compared to men, right? Can you walk us through some of the common indicators that we might not be thinking about?
Sure. Linda, thank you for sharing your story. So it's still important to remember that for all comers, both men and women, that chest pain, chest pressure, chest heaviness, however you want to describe it, discomfort in the chest is still the most common symptom for both men and women. But it is true that women tend to have more unusual symptoms. Indigestion is definitely a presentation I have heard on multiple occasions, in addition to other things, extreme exhaustion, excessive, you know, tiredness, nausea, pain in other places, jaw pain, back pain, shoulder pain, neck pain. And the presentation can be different for everybody. And we have to really be extra vigilant, I think, in women because they are more likely to have these atypical symptoms. I should also say shortness of breath would be a really common one in women. So when you hear these sort of things, it does raise some alarms.
Now, Linda, you mentioned you were slightly embarrassed to go in or were expecting to just kind of be told off and, you know, you're just experiencing this, you know, here you go, come back another time. But, you know, this is an example of women who wait longer to get treatment, not just for heart attacks, for a lot of things, but women wait almost 40 hours longer than men when it comes to heart attack treatment. So, I mean, Linda, you can speak about this personally, but Dr. Gardner, I'm interested in your perspective as well. You know, why is this?
I think it's a multitude of factors, but I think that women in general are caregivers. They tend to worry a lot about the people around them, the people they love, and sometimes they put themselves on the back burner and might not even realize the symptoms that they're having and have a tendency to sometimes ignore really alarming symptoms. But that being said, historically, most of what we understand about heart disease was done on studies that were mostly conducted on middle-aged men. And that's changed now. But if you look at sort of the representation in clinical trials, women are still underrepresented in clinical trials. And so what we understand about heart disease and how to treat heart disease is still not completely reflective of women. So I think that women may ignore their symptoms. That leads to a delay. Medical professionals may not take the symptoms seriously initially, especially if they don't have as many traditional risk factors. And this all leads to delays in diagnosis and delays in treatment.
Do you feel differently about things, Linda? I mean, I imagine your experience, you're cautioning everyone to, you know, don't ignore or watch out for things.
Yeah, everything changes, to be frank. It changes in the best ways. And it also, I guess it's the best way, everything changes. But, you know, everything clarifies very quickly in those moments. It's supposed to. And part of your healing is also supposed to be that you forget some of it, which is good. It's a good thing. But in terms of how I feel about my body now, I'm incredibly in tune to it. I need to be because there's certain things I need to look for to ensure I don't run into trouble again. While in the ICU after, I said, I need to get the word out about this because I'm of a certain age. I'm very young, relatively healthy to have a heart attack, but I had it, and I had what they call the widowmaker. It was as serious as it gets, and so I talked to everyone about it, which is sometimes a little bit TMI, but it's really important. And this is another example, I think, of women, is that we are often unlikely to share some of the hardest parts that we're dealing with our health because we're somehow made to feel guilty if we're not in our best shape. But we also, as caregivers and as, you know, childbearers, our bodies go through a lot. We take on a lot. We have to take care of ourselves. You know, when I was in the hospital, my cardiologist there, you know, he said, you're going to have a part-time job, which is taking care of your heart for a while. And that means a completely different diet, focusing on myself, learning to say no, so that I can really focus my energy on things that are important to me, and going to cardiac rehab. Because the thing about the rehab is that I'm unfortunately part of a club that you don't really want to be a part of anymore, and that's someone who's had, you know, a heart attack. And not many people understand what that's like. So it's helpful to have people there, too, to talk to. And, you know, the care team there understands it. And that helps a lot as well. So it's the upside of this very hard situation.
I guess I would also add that sort of as part of the post-heart attack journey is that we really want to focus on risk factors. So whether you've never had a heart attack or you've already had a heart attack, we really concentrate on optimizing your risk factors. And so for both men and women, the number one risk factors are smoking, diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, high cholesterol. Those are the things that we focus on. However, there really are some unique risk factors that we should pay attention to in women. Things like gestational diabetes, so diabetes in pregnancy, hypertension in pregnancy, those actually give you an increased risk of having cardiac events later on in life. Premature menopause, so menopause before age 40 will increase your risk for cardiac events. Things like depression, which are a little bit more common in women. But even if you look at things like inflammatory conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, those conditions are more common in women, but also are what we would consider risk enhancers. They do enhance your risk for later cardiac events. So yes, even though you have already had a heart attack and the horse is out of the barn, we really have to optimize all of those risk factors the best we can to prevent subsequent events.
Right.
I would like to actually put an exclamation point on that, because when I was in the hospital post-heart attack, the cardiologist asked me a number of questions, and I kept saying yes, yes, yes. There were risk factors I didn't know I had. Mm. And it may have altered some choices I made in my lifestyle if I had known that. And the gestational diabetes is a perfect example of that. I had never had that conversation before. So that awareness alone can really help someone understand their potential risk.
Linda Kiewit is a heart attack survivor. And Dr. Stacy Gardner is an assistant professor at Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin. She's also one of the people who treated Linda. They spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why Wisconsin is so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday, leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. And did you know there's hidden treasure in Milwaukee, or that there are graveyards hidden in some Milwaukee neighborhoods? We'll explore some of the city's lesser-known history in about 20 minutes. But first, we'll learn about raptors and meet Otis, one of the raptors in the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center's raptor program. That's coming up next on Lake Effect, on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's peak birding season in Wisconsin, and if you look high in the sky, you'll likely see some raptors soaring. Raptors like hawks, owls, and vultures sometimes get a bad reputation, but these birds of prey play a huge ecological role. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Lindsay Foch, the raptor program director at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She explains why raptors are important, the challenges they face, and what's being done to help conserve raptors throughout the state.
Lindsay, I'm so excited to be speaking with you today for the fourth episode of Chirp Chat. I can't believe it. Today is especially fun because we'll be talking about all things raptors. You're the perfect person to be talking to about this.
Oh, thank you. It's my favorite topic too, so I'm very excited to be participating.
So I want you to tell me a little bit about the raptor program here at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center.
Yes, so we have a very unique program here. Our raptor program consists of 15 non-releasable birds, and what we do with them is education throughout the entire state of Wisconsin. So all of our birds represent species you can see in Wisconsin, and they were injured, they can't survive out in the wild. They've come to Schlitz Audubon to live here and help us with our education. So then we're able to go into schools and libraries and public events with our birds to teach about ecology, about conservation, about the natural history of these birds, and then people can see them up close and personal, which is an experience that is extremely memorable. And so we're able to provide that and help kind of spread environmental awareness.
I'm interested though, what makes a bird a raptor?
Yeah, we get that question a lot. When we're talking about raptors, it's a group of birds, predatory birds. They have three defining characteristics that put them into the raptor category. So one is forward-facing eyes, so that they can see really, really well with binocular vision. They have a hooked upper beak to help tear their prey into bite-sized pieces. And then they have extremely strong feet with sharp talons. And those feet and talons are their number one tool to help them catch and carry their prey away. So when we're thinking of raptors, we're thinking of eagles, hawks, falcons, owls. They're really birds of all sizes, predatory birds that will go and catch prey.
Amazing. And so are those birds that you just mentioned, are they common in the Milwaukee area?
Yeah, we have a number of raptor species that you can find throughout the Milwaukee area. Especially now, being in May, a lot of our raptors have migrated through or migrated up, if they have, and they're nesting right now. So throughout Milwaukee, you can see owls of all different shapes and sizes. You can have great horned owls and barred owls. And we have red-tailed hawks. Red-tailed hawks are actually one of the most common raptors in all of North America, and we have them all throughout Milwaukee. Cooper's hawks, sharp-shinned hawks, and in the last several years, bald eagles are regularly seen in Milwaukee, which is very exciting.
That is exciting. I'm thinking, we just talked about spring migration in the last episode of Chirp Chat. Do they have a similar migration pattern to songbirds, raptors?
Yeah, some of our raptor species in Wisconsin will migrate. And some, like broadwing hawks, will migrate all the way down to South America. These huge migrations, wow, which is really impressive. And then every March-ish, they will all take to the skies and come all the way back up north. There are other raptors, though, that don't have to migrate. So great horned owls, for example, they will stay here all year round. And that's because they can survive our winters. They can find their food during the wintertime. And they are early nesters, too. So they'll nest in January, February. So our raptor species have adapted in how they need to survive. And another thing that biologists are actually finding is that some raptor species are migrating less. So the peregrine falcons that used to live in Wisconsin and in the Milwaukee area used to migrate, but they're finding that more peregrines are sticking around throughout our winters. So they're studying why these changes are happening and how they're utilizing the environment around them.
That makes sense. So what I find interesting about raptors is that sometimes they can be misunderstood. I know they play an important role in our ecosystem. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. So raptors are what we call indicator species. So what that means is that their abundance or their absence is actually an indication of the health of the ecosystem as a whole. So we can watch their populations, and whatever their populations are doing, we can then, like if there's a huge decline, we can look further into any environmental issues that are going on.
huge example of that is what was going on with the peregrine falcons. And their populations declined so drastically, they actually were extirpated from the area.
Wow.
So there were no more. So it caused people to look further into what is going on? Why, you know, what is going on with our raptor species? Found out that there's that chemical DDT that people were using. It was working its way up the food chain and affecting the raptor species. So by keeping an eye on our raptor populations, we can really evaluate the environment. The other role, very important role that raptors play in the environment is that they keep the balance between predator and prey. So if our prey species, our small rodents, you know, if we didn't have raptors around, the small rodents and a lot of things that we would possibly find as pests, but those populations would boom. And there would be an increase in the spread of disease, crop issues. I mean, it just big things. So our predators, our raptors, will keep those in check. Mm-hmm. And there's then this delicate balance in the ecosystem that our raptors help preserve.
I was going to say a really balancing role that they play. So in addition to things like DDT that you mentioned, what are some of the biggest threats that raptors face?
Yeah. So wonderfully, DDT was outlawed in the country. Right now, especially if we're thinking about Wisconsin and like the southeastern Wisconsin area, things that threaten our raptor species are, a big one is rodenticides. So people will use poisons to target things that we don't like rats and mice, and we don't want them around our homes. So people will put out these poisons. What happens is that a mouse will ingest that, and it doesn't kill the mouse right away, but instead it actually just slows them down for a while. That becomes a really easy prey item then for a raptor species. So an owl will see it and it easily grab it, right? Because it's so much easier. They'll then consume that poison. So our raptor species are showing up at wildlife rehab centers at alarming rates with poisoning, both through rodenticides, and another one is lead. So lead is out in the environment, and it will find its way into a fish, for example, with a tackle. A bald eagle then will grab that fish, because bald eagles love to eat fish. The bald eagle ingests the lead, and then they suffer from the lead poisoning and lead toxicity. So we really want to be aware of, you know, those chemicals that are out there. And again, the raptors are the indicator species, right? So they're showing us that it is out there in the environment.
And I know that the Migratory Bird Act is one of the oldest wildlife protection laws. Does it protect all raptors?
It does cover raptors as well, yes. Any native migratory birds, so our great horned owls, our red-tailed hawks, our bald eagles, it is all protected under that treaty. And on top of that, there's an additional regulation that protects eagles. So bald eagles and golden eagles have additional regulations and protections over them.
And that protects raptors from people capturing them or killing them.
Absolutely, yes. Even their feathers are protected.
Really?
So if you were hiking and you found a red-tailed hawk feather, you actually cannot possess that feather without permits.
Wow.
That's how detailed that act is. And the reason for it is because a freshly molted, like a naturally molted feather, you can't look at it and there's no physical difference of that feather or one that was plucked. So in order to protect birds, they've protected their feathers as well. Because if you already like reviewed, you know, that act, a lot of the motivation of that was because people were harvesting birds for their feathers and for fashion.
Right.
So they've protected even their little feathers, even their eggs. Everything about these birds is protected.
That's good to hear. So in addition to the conservation and educational work that the Raptor Program here at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center provides, what are some different conservation efforts happening throughout Milwaukee and Wisconsin?
There are some fantastic organizations that are putting a lot of focus and effort into raptor conservation, as well as running scientific studies to monitor these populations and see what's going on. One that I think of right off the top of my head are the peregrine falcon nest boxes that are sponsored by We Energies. And they work with a biologist, but they install nest boxes at power plants and all around the state of Wisconsin to provide nesting habitat. Peregrines are still endangered in the state of Wisconsin. So all of this work is really, really important to make sure that their population stays stable. And another one is the Central Wisconsin Kestrel Research Organization. And what they do is they put up kestrel nest boxes in like the perfect habitat for kestrels, hopefully to invite them into nest, which is very important because the kestrel populations right now are declining. Mm. So biologists are really trying to figure out why are they declining. I mean, small little falcon, big impact on the environment, so we're trying to figure out why. So there are these wonderful environmental organizations that are really putting in that effort to help out.
Right, and what can be done to bring them back.
Absolutely.
So before we wrap up, how can people care for raptors and help protect them? Just, you know, people like me, everyday people.
Everybody can do something, absolutely. And that is something that we talk about at our programs all the time, because even every little bit helps, right? And things that people can do, even in their own yards, they can do native planting for wildlife, for songbirds, you know, but then it can also help our raptor species, and it helps kind of protect that diversity of the environment. Don't use rodenticides. Don't use rodenticides. If you have a mouse problem, one of the best things to do that we tell people, and it works, is you can actually put out an owl nest box in your yard or on your property in hopes to attract either screech owls or, you know, bigger owls to nest in your area, and they'll take care of the rodent problem for you. A family of owls can actually consume up to 10,000 mice in a year.
Oh my gosh.
So they're the best neighbors. They're the best neighbors. And that way we don't have to be using those poisons. Other things that are super simple is don't litter. If you think about it, if you're driving down the freeway and you're eating an apple and you're done and you have the core left, often people will just open the window and just toss it, right? You just toss it out onto the highway and you keep going on your way. But what happens is that, well, if we're littering, it's attracting rodents and you're on a roadside, right? So your rodents are coming to places where cars are traveling and the rodents are going to attract raptors. So raptors are going to then be trying to hunt around our roadways where they can be hit by cars. So all these little things really do help. They really do make a big difference. Just being aware of our surroundings and taking care of nature.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
So at the end of every Chirp Chat, I love for guests to shine a spotlight on a bird for the month. I know we'll make our way right now to the Raptor Center. I'm so excited to see who you'll be highlighting.
I am so excited to share it with you.
So Lindsay, we're here at the Raptor facility. Tell me who we are spotlighting this month for Chirp Chat.
This is our handsome peregrine falcon. His name is Otis. Otis was hatched in 2013, so he is actually 11 years old this year. Peregrine falcons are extremely amazing birds. A lot of people are familiar with them. They're endangered in the state of Wisconsin. So there's some great organizations that are doing work to make sure we can protect peregrine falcons out in the wild. This is the fastest animal on the planet.
Wow.
So peregrine falcons have been clocked diving up to speeds of 240 miles an hour. So they're faster than a cheetah. They're faster than anything on land or in the sea. Their entire body is extremely aerodynamic. So you can see he's built like a little torpedo. Otis was out in the wild, and approximately the first or second year of his life, he experienced a very bad collision. We don't know the details of that collision, but he found himself at a wildlife rehab facility. And as you look at Otis right now, you can see his left wing has a very obvious physical deformity there. So it was broken very, very badly. He was in rehab. They tried to fix it. They couldn't. And then from there, he actually worked as an animal ambassador at a couple other facilities before he joined us in 2021. So we were able to showcase him, give people these really up-close experiences with peregrine falcons, you know, one of the most amazing animals and predators on the planet. And Otis does it so well.
And tell me a little bit about the color on Otis. Does it protect them from anything out in the wild, or what are the characteristics of Otis?
Yes, he's absolutely beautiful. So he's got this wonderful dark gray out his wings and his back. He's got this spotting on his chest. And if you look at his face, our falcons have these lines that go down from their eyes down to like what we would call like their chin, their neck. Those are called malar stripes. The dark lines on a falcon's face actually helps deflect sunlight so that the birds can see in really bright situations in the bright environment. And we know people like that, like football players will put dark lines under their eyes. So it helps the birds. The peregrine's natural habitat is often cliff sides. So if they're perched up on high cliffs, this dark coloration is going to help them blend in with it. Underneath, though, you can see on Otis, his coloring is much lighter. It's a light gray. It's got speckles on them. As these guys then, and for almost all of our raptor species, as they're soaring up in the sky, if you look at them from below, the lighter color actually helps them blend into the sky so that prey species can't see them. So yeah, absolutely phenomenal adaptations.
Well, Lindsay, I really appreciate you bringing out Otis and sharing him with us and our listeners. He is so beautiful.
We're happy to do it. It's really something special to be able to share these birds. So
thank you.
Lindsay Foch is the Raptor Program and Animal Ambassador Director at the Schlitz Audubon Nature Center. She spoke with Lake Effects expert Nunez for a monthly series we call Chirp Chat. If you want to be part of next month's Chirp Chat, send us your spark bird story. Head to WUWM.com for information on what we're looking for and how to get it to us. But first, we'll learn about some of Milwaukee's strangest history and quirkiest stories. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Every Milwaukeean has their favorite fun facts about the city, something no one else seems to know. Now a new book has gathered dozens of those stories into one collection. Secret Milwaukee by Jim Nelson is full of fun, lesser-known stories about the Cream City, and he joins me now to share a few of them. There are a lot of stories in here that I think some like diehard Milwaukee history people are going to go, oh yeah, I know this and right. That story. But what are the stories that you found as you were doing this that you went, oh, I didn't know about that. Oh, this is interesting.
Well, I'd have to say the biggest one for me, I don't know where I'd been, but the treasure of Byron Price. So there's a total of 84 locations in the book. That number was given to me by the publisher. And I had a good 75 to 80 ideas, you know, that I was working on, but I needed like those last few. And so I decided to crowdsource it using Facebook. So I put something out and said like, hey, is there something you'd like to know more about? Something strange, weird, or obscure? And a friend of mine told me to look into this and said that she and her family are just like obsessed with trying to find this treasure, this buried treasure somewhere in Milwaukee. I've lived here my whole life. I had never heard of this. I researched it. Had a blast looking into this, was going all over Lake Park trying to find not this treasure, but so much just like, can I find the trail that leads to the treasure would be nice. So that one was a lot of fun to write.
Of the stories that you wrote about, of course, we're not going to get to 70 or 80 of them. We're going to talk about just a couple here. But what are some of the ones that you find really interesting that I guess maybe you're surprised people don't know about?
One of the more surprising concepts, I would say, is cemetery history. And that actually bubbles up in a couple of the stories that I wrote into the book. Because once a cemetery is a cemetery, it's kind of hard to move it. Like, it can be done, but it's not done frequently. And when it is done, it's always controversial, like relocating graves and that sort of thing. And so what's happened is as the city and its suburbs have grown and they have taken over formerly rural lands, they now kind of surround some of these old closed cemeteries. And one of the things that's very interesting is they're just kind of hidden in plain sight. Like you may drive past them, but you don't know that they're there. And oftentimes by design because the city or the suburbs don't want people kind of trespassing on this cemetery land, and so they've deliberately not marked them. And I know there's one near Levy Cemetery near where I've lived most of my life. I had absolutely no idea it was there, and I started to do some research, and I found the old cemetery and got onto the land, and sure enough, there are a couple of graves there and probably a few dozen unmarked graves as well.
Interesting. Now, this is kind of cemetery adjacent, but a story that I learned pretty recently that I know you talk about in your book is Milwaukee's interesting relationship to the origin story of The Exorcist. Now, can you dig into that a little bit?
Yeah, it's true. So there were three priests who were involved in the actual real exorcist. And there's this young boy who was believed to be possessed by the devil. He had grown up in a Lutheran family. Supposedly, an aunt of his introduced him to a Ouija board, and that's, according to the family legend, is what started it all. And when the parents became very concerned because of, like, flying objects and that sort of thing in their home, as one would become concerned. And they initially went to their Lutheran pastor, who evaluated him and said, you're going to need an exorcism, and that means you need to go to the Catholic Church. And apparently the boy was evaluated by a psychologist as well as a parapsychologist who specialized in phenomena of the paranormal, and everyone agreed. It took a while, but they were finally able to find a priest who was able to do it, and he was assisted by two younger priests who needed to hold the boy down. And one of those two younger priests later went on to become a professor at Marquette University and lived here for decades until his retirement, did not talk about it very often and his experiences with that. And he is interred at Calvary Cemetery right here in Milwaukee.
Yeah. It's an interesting just little nugget of history. And I think this book is really just full of these nuggets of history, as it were. What would you say is your favorite bit of history that you put into this book?
You know, I have so many, it's hard to choose. I think one of the stories that I was very just fascinated by was the story of Dirty Helen Crommell. And her book has actually recently, her autobiography has recently been re-released. And it's the story of the most notorious brothel keeper in Milwaukee during Prohibition. Now, for most of the stories in the book, for almost all of them, there's a site that you can actually go to do some touring. So, you know, obviously you can go to a cemetery, that's free, and you can go to some of these historic buildings, and either for nothing or very low cost, you can gain admission and take a look around. But the Sunflower Inn, which Helen managed during Prohibition, it's gone. You know, it's just a parking lot. I actually went to the parking lot and just to kind of reconnect, and I took a picture, ended up not putting it in the book. But her life story, which I'm not going to reveal in this interview because I want you to buy the book, but her life story is just so compelling. How she arrived in Milwaukee, the things that she did here, how she ended up living out her final days, that even though you can't visit the Sunflower Inn, I had to put it in the book anyway. It's such a great story.
Now, most of these are places that you can visit, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
What do you hope people take away from this book? Do you hope that they go on kind of an adventure of Milwaukee? Do you hope they just learn a little bit more about their hometown?
I'd really like to see that a lot. I think that the more we can connect people to places in the community, places they haven't been before, it just helps everyone develop a sense of identity. And when you develop a sense of identity that is Milwaukee-based, you tend to care more about the city itself, as well as the people who inhabit the city. So, you know, sort of one of my big goals is to try to, like, bring people together. But in the meantime, just get out, get to know your city. Each site, each story is only 2 pages long, so it's very digestible. It's easy to read. Find something that you like. Find something that you didn't know that was there. Go visit that, too. And then if you like it, hang around for a while. Have dinner at one of the neighborhood restaurants. Talk to some of the locals in the neighborhood or read up some more in one of my other books, perhaps, or go online and find something else that you can read about that neighborhood, about that site, about the people who live there, and kind of see this book as an entryway to greater learning.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Jim Nelson is the author of Secret Milwaukee, as well as many other books about the region. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll help you plan a road trip on Wisconsin's Great River Road. Plus, we'll hear a live performance for the latest Live at Lake Effect. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.